Come, let's go away together. I'll show you many different countries. I'll be a famous composer, of course, and you'll be as beautiful as you are at this very moment. And your wife? And my husband? What will we do about them? She said, forcing herself to laugh. He whistled softly. Who knows where they'll be? Or us? But, madame, I'm very serious. I'll be back. Play something else, Lucille said after a brief silence.
No, enough. Too much music ist gefährlich. Dangerous. Now you must play the society lady. Invite me to have some tea.
There's no more tea in all of France, mein Herr. I can offer you some wine from Frontignan and some cakes. Would you like that?
Oh, yes. But please don't call the servant. Let me help you set the table.
Tell me where the tablecloths are. In this drawer? Allow me to choose one. You know, we Germans are very bold. I'd like the pink one.
No, the white one, embroidered with little flowers.
Did you embroider it?
But of course. The rest I leave to you.
That's good, she said, laughing. Where's your dog? I haven't seen him lately.
He's away on leave. He belongs to the whole regiment, to all the soldiers. One of them took him with them. Bonnet, the interpreter, the one your country friend was complaining about. They left for 3 days in Munich, but the new orders mean they'll have to come back.
Speaking of Bonnet, did you talk to him?
Madame, my friend Bonnet is not a simple fellow. Until now he's been having some innocent fun, but if the husband starts getting frustrated, he's capable of getting really involved. Schadenfreude, do you understand? He could even fall in love for real. And if the young woman isn't faithful...
There's no question of that, said Lucille.
She really loves that country bumpkin?
Without a doubt. And don't think that all the women around here are the same, just because certain young girls let themselves get involved with your soldiers. Madeleine Savary is a good wife and a good Frenchwoman.
I understand, said the officer, nodding his head.
He helped Lucille move the card table over to the window. She put out some antique crystal glasses cut with large facets, the wine carafe with the gilt silver stopper, and some small painted dessert plates. They dated back to the First Empire and were decorated with military scenes, Napoleon inspecting the troops, hussars in gold brocade setting up camp in a clearing, a parade along the Champ de Mars. The German admired the strong, bright colours.
What beautiful uniforms! How I'd love to own a jacket embroidered in gold like that hussar.
Have some cakes, mein Herr. They're homemade.
He looked at her and smiled.
Madame, have you ever heard of those cyclones which rage in the South Seas? If I've understood what I've read, they form a sort of circle whose edges are made of wind and rain, but whose centre is so still that a bird or even a butterfly caught in the eye of the storm wouldn't be harmed. Their wings would remain unruffled, while all around them the most horrible damage was being unleashed. Look at this house. Look at us about to have our wine from Frontignan and our cakes. And think of what's going on in the rest of the world.
I prefer not to think about it, Lucille replied sadly.
Nevertheless, in her soul she felt a kind of warmth she never felt before. Even her gestures were more delicate, more adept than usual, and she listened to her own voice as if it were a stranger's. It was lower than normal, this voice, deeper and more vibrant. She didn't recognize it. Most exquisite of all was this sense of being on an island in the middle of the hostile house, and this strange feeling of safety. No one would come in. There would be no letters, no visits, no telephone calls. Even the old clock she'd forgotten to wind that morning. What would Madame Angelier say? Of course nothing gets done when I'm away. Even the old clock, whose grave, melancholy tones frightened her, was silent. Once again, the storm had damaged the power station. No lights or radios were on for miles. The radio silent. How peaceful. It was impossible to give in to temptation, impossible to look for Paris, London, Berlin, Boston on the dark dial, impossible to hear those mournful, invisible, cursed voices, telling of ships being sunk, planes crashing, cities destroyed, reading out the number of dead, predicting future massacres. Just blessed forgetfulness. Nothing else. Until nightfall. Time passing slowly. Someone beside her. glass of light, fragrant wine, music, long silences, happiness. Chapter 13. 1 month later, on a rainy afternoon like the one the German and Lucille had spent together, Marthe announced that the Angelier ladies had visitors. Three women were shown into the sitting room. They wore long black coats, mourning hats, and black veils that cascaded down towards the ground, imprisoning them in a kind of impenetrable, mournful cage. The Angeliers didn't often have guests. The cook, flustered, had forgotten to take their umbrellas. They still held them, half open in their hands, like bell-shaped calyx flowers, catching the last few drops of rain dripping from their veils, or like the funeral urns on the tombs of heroes into which stone women weep. Madame Angelier had some difficulty in recognizing the three black shapes. Then she said, surprised, "But it's the Perrin ladies." The Perrin family, proprietors of the beautiful estate pillaged by the Germans, was the region's finest. Madame Angelier's feelings towards the bearers of this name were comparable to those one member of a royal family might feel towards another, calm certainty that one was among kindred spirits, who held the same opinions about everything, that despite the fleeting differences which might naturally occur, despite wars or governmental misconduct, they remained united by an indissoluble bond, to such an extent that if the Spanish royal family were dethroned, the Swedish royal family would feel the repercussions. When the Perrins had lost 900,000 francs after a lawyer in Moulins had run off, the Angeliers felt the aftershock. When Madame Angelier had paid a pittance for a piece of land that had belonged to the Montmorts since time began, the Perrins had rejoiced. The grudging respect the Montmorts received from the middle classes bore no comparison to this sense of shared values. Madame Angelier warmly asked Madame Perrin to sit down again. She'd started to get up when she saw her hostess coming towards her. She didn't experience the disagreeable feeling she always had when Madame de Montmort came to visit. She knew the Perrin ladies approved of everything. The mock fireplace, the musty smell, the half-closed shutters, the slipcovers on the furniture, the olive-green wallpaper with silver palm leaves. Everything was as it should be. She would soon be offering her guests a pitcher of orangeade and some stale shortbread. Madame Perrin would not be shocked by the stinginess of this offering. She would simply see it as one more proof of the Angelier's wealth, for the richer one is, the stingier as well. She would identify with her own tendency to save money and the inclination towards asceticism that lies at the heart of the French middle classes and makes their shameful secret pleasures even more bittersweet. Madame Perrin told them that her son had died a hero's death in Normandy as the Germans advanced. She had received permission to visit his grave. She complained at great length about the cost of this journey, and Madame Angelier sympathized with her. Maternal love and money were two completely different things. The Perrins lived in Lyon. "The city is destitute. I've seen crows being sold for 15 francs each. Mothers are feeding their children on crow soup. And don't think I'm talking about the working classes. No, madame. I'm talking about people like you and me." Madame Angelier sighed sadly. She imagined her relatives, members of her family, sharing a crow for supper. The idea was somehow grotesque, scandalous. Though if it had been just the working classes, all they would have done was say, "Those poor creatures," and then move on. "Well, at least you have your freedom. You don't have any Germans living with you like us." "Yes, madame. Here, in this house, behind that wall," said Madame Angelier, pointing to the olive-green wallpaper with the silver palm leaves, "an officer." "We know," said Madame Perrin, slightly embarrassed. "We heard about it from the notary's wife who came to Lyon. Actually, that's why we've come." They all involuntarily looked at Lucille. "Please explain what you mean," Madame Angelier said coldly. "I've heard that this officer behaves absolutely correctly, is that right?
Yes.
And he's even been seen speaking to you extremely politely on several occasions?
He never speaks to me, Madame Angélier said haughtily. I wouldn't stand for it. I accept that my attitude may not be very reasonable, she stressed this last word, as has been pointed out to me, but I am the mother of a prisoner of war, and because of that, even if I were offered all the money in the world, I wouldn't consider these gentlemen as anything but our mortal enemies. Although other people are more, how can I put it, more flexible, more realistic, perhaps. My daughter-in-law in particular.
I answer him if he speaks to me, yes, said Lucille. But you're so right, absolutely right, exclaimed Madame Perrin. My dear girl, I'm putting all my hope in you. It's about our poor house. You've seen what a terrible state it's in. I've only seen the garden through the gates. My dear child, do you think you could possibly arrange for us to have back certain items from inside the house to which we are particularly attached? Madame, but I... You mustn't refuse. All you have to do is speak to these gentlemen and intervene on our behalf. It might all have been burned or damaged, of course, but I can't believe the house has been so vandalized that it is impossible to recover our family portraits, correspondence or furniture of sentimental value only to us. Madame, you should speak to the Germans occupying your house yourself and...
Never, said Madame Perrin, pulling herself up to her full height.
Never will I cross the threshold of my house while the enemy is there. It is a question of dignity and sensitivity. They killed my son, who had just been accepted to study at the École Polytechnique in the top six. I'll be staying at the Hôtel des Voyageurs with my daughters until tomorrow. If you could arrange to have certain things returned to us, I would be eternally grateful. Here's the list. If I found myself face to face with one of these Germans, I wouldn't be able to stop myself singing the Marseillaise. I know myself, said Madame Perrin in an impassioned voice. And then I'd get deported to Prussia. Not that that would be a disgrace, far from it. But I have daughters. I must keep going for my family. So I am truly begging you, my dear Lucille, to do whatever you can for me.
Here's the list, said Madame Perrin's younger daughter. She unfolded the paper and began reading. A china bowl and water jug with our monogram, decorated with butterflies. A salad dryer. The white and gold tea service, 28 pieces, the sugar bowl is missing its lid. Two portraits of grandfather, one sitting on his nanny's lap, two on his deathbed. The stag's antlers from the entrance hall, a memento of my uncle Adolphe. Granny's plate warmer, porcelain and vermeil. Papa's extra set of false teeth he'd left behind in the bathroom. The pink and black sofa from the sitting room. In the left-hand drawer of the desk, key herewith, my brother's first page of writing. Papa's letters to Mama while he was away taking the waters in Vittel in 1924, tied with a pink ribbon. All our family photographs. There was a deathly silence as she read. Madame Perrin cried softly beneath her veil.
It's hard, so hard to watch things you care about so much being taken away from you. I beg you, my dear Lucille, do everything you can. Be clever, persuasive.
Lucille looked at her mother-in-law. This officer, said Madame Angélier, barely moving her lips, has not yet come back. You won't see him tonight, Lucille, it's too late. But tomorrow you could speak with him and ask for his help.
All right, I will.
Madame Perrin, her hands covered in black gloves, hugged Lucille.
Thank you, my dear child. And now we must go.
Not before having some refreshments, said Madame Angélier.
Oh, but we don't want to impose on you. Don't be ridiculous.
They made quiet, courteous little noises when Martha brought in the pitcher of orangeade and the shortbread.
Now that they felt reassured, they began talking about the war. They feared a German victory, yet weren't altogether happy at the idea that the English might win. All in all, they preferred everyone to be defeated. They blamed their difficulties on the fact that the desire for pleasure seemed to have taken hold of everyone. Then the conversation returned to more personal matters. Madame Perrin and Madame Angélier discussed their poor health. Madame Perrin went into great detail about her last bout of rheumatism, while Madame Angélier listened impatiently, and as soon as Madame Perrin paused for breath, interjected, "It's the same with me," and talked about her own bout of rheumatism. Madame Perrin's daughters discreetly ate their shortbread. Outside, the rain kept falling. Chapter 14. By the next morning, the rain had stopped, and the sun shone down on the damp, joyous ground. It was early, and Lucille, who hadn't slept well, was sitting on a garden bench, waiting for the German to come out of the house. As soon as she saw him, she went up to him and explained her request. Both of them sensed the hidden presence of Madame Angélier and the cook, not to mention the neighbours, who were spying on the couple from behind closed shutters as they stood on the path. "If you would accompany me to these ladies' house," said the German, "I will have all the things they've requested gathered together for you. But a number of our soldiers have been billeted in this house since the owners abandoned it, and I think the damage has been considerable. Let's go and see." They walked through the village, side by side, barely speaking. Lucille saw Madame Perrin's black veil fluttering from a window of the Hôtel des Voyageurs. They were watching Lucille and her companion with curiosity, complicity, and a vague sense of approval. It was clear that everyone knew she was on her way to extract from the enemy the crumbs of his conquest in the form of a set of false teeth, a china dinner service, and other household items of sentimental value. An old woman who couldn't even look at a German uniform without being terrified nevertheless came up to Lucille and whispered, "That's it. Well done. At least you're not afraid of them." The officer smiled. "They think you're Judith going to murder Holofernes in his tent. I hope you don't have the same evil plan. Here we are. Please come in, madame." He pushed open the heavy gate. The little bell that used to tell the Perrins they had visitors tinkled sadly. In just 1 year, the garden had become so neglected it would have broken your heart to look at it, had it not been such a beautiful day. But it was a May morning, the day after a storm. The grass was sparkling, the damp paths overgrown with daisies, cornflowers, and all sorts of other wild flowers that gleamed in the sun. The flower beds were a riot of shrubs, and fresh clusters of lilacs gently brushed against Lucille's face as she walked by. In the house, they found about a dozen young soldiers and all the children from the village, who spent happy days playing in the entrance hall. Like the Angéliers' hall, it was dark, with a vaguely musty smell, greenish panes of glass in the windows, and hunting trophies on the walls. Lucille recognised the cartmaker's two little girls, sitting on the lap of a blonde soldier who had a wide grin on his face. The carpenter's little boy was playing horsey on the back of another soldier. The illegitimate children of the dressmaker, all four of them, aged 2 to 6, were lying on the floor, plaiting crowns out of forget-me-nots and the small, sweet-smelling carnations that had once lined the formal borders. The soldiers leapt to attention, the way they do in the army, chin up, eyes straight ahead, the whole body so tense you could see the veins in their necks throbbing slightly. "Would you be so kind as to give me your list?" the officer said to Lucille. "We can look for the things together." He read it and smiled. "Let's start with the sofa. It must be in the sitting room. Over here, I assume." He opened the door and went into a large room full of furniture, much of it knocked over or broken. The paintings had been removed and stacked against the walls. Several had been kicked in. The floor was scattered with scraps of newspaper, bits of straw, vestiges, presumably, of the mass exodus in June 1940, and cigar stubs left by the invaders. On a pedestal stood a stuffed bulldog with a broken muzzle and a crown of dead flowers. "What a terrible sight," said Lucille, upset. In spite of everything, there was something comical about the room, and especially about the sheepish expression on the faces of the soldiers and the officer. Seeing the look of reproach on Lucille's face, the officer said sharply, "My parents used to have a villa on the Rhine. Your soldiers occupied it during the last war. They smashed rare, priceless musical instruments that had been in the family for 200 years, and tore up books that once belonged to Goethe." Lucille couldn't help but smile. He was defending himself in the same crude and indignant way a little boy does when accused of some misdeed. "But I wasn't the one who started it, it was the others." She felt a very feminine pleasure, an almost sensual, sweet sensation at seeing this childish look on a face that was, after all, the face of an implacable enemy, a hardened warrior. "But we can't pretend," she thought, "that we aren't all in his hands. We're defenceless. If we still have our lives and our possessions, it's only because of his goodwill." She was almost afraid of the feelings growing within her. It was like stroking a wild animal, an exquisitely intense sensation, a mixture of tenderness and terror. Wanting to hold on to the feeling a little longer, she frowned. "You should be ashamed. These empty houses were under the protection of the German army, the honour of the German army." As he listened to her, he lightly tapped the back of his boots with his riding crop. He turned towards his soldiers and gave them a good dressing down. Lucille realized he was ordering them to get the house back in order, to fix what had been broken, to polish the floors and the furniture. His voice, when he spoke German, especially with that commanding tone, took on a sharp, resonant quality. Hearing it gave Lucille the same pleasure that a slightly rough kiss might, the kind of kiss that ends with a little bite. She slowly brought her hands to her burning face. "Stop it," she said to herself. "Stop thinking about him. You're asking for trouble." She took a few steps towards the door. "I'm going home. You have the list. You can ask your soldiers to find everything." In a flash, he was by her side.
"Please don't go away angry, I beg of you. Everything will be repaired as well as possible. I give you my word. Listen, let's let them look for everything. They can put it all in a wheelbarrow, and under supervision from you, take it straight over to the Perrin ladies. I'll go with you to apologize. I can't do more than that. In the meantime, come into the garden. We could go for a little walk, and I'll pick some beautiful flowers for you."
"No, I'm going home."
"You can't," he said, taking her by the arm. "You promised the ladies you'd bring them their things. You have to stay and make sure your orders are carried out."
They were outside now, standing on a path bordered with lilacs in full bloom. A multitude of honeybees, bumblebees and wasps were flying all around them, diving into the flowers, drinking their honey and settling on Lucille's arms and hair. She was frightened and laughed nervously. "Oh, we can't stay here. Everywhere I go is dangerous."
"Let's walk on a little further."
They came across the village children at the back of the garden. Some of them were playing in the flower beds where everything had been pulled up and trampled. Others had climbed the pear trees and were breaking off the branches. "Little beasts," said Lucille. "There'll be no fruit this year."
"Yes, but the flowers are so beautiful."
He stretched out his arms, and the children threw him some small branches with clusters of delicate petals.
"Take them, madame. The petals will be wonderful in a bowl on the table."
"I would never dare walk through the village carrying branches from a fruit tree," Lucille protested, laughing.
"Just wait, you little devils, the policeman will catch you."
"Not a chance,"
said a little girl in a black smock. She was eating a jam sandwich while wrapping her dirty little legs round a tree and climbing up.
"Not a chance. The Germans won't let them in."
The lawn hadn't been mowed for 2 summers and was dotted with buttercups. The officer spread out his large, pale, almost almond-green cape and sat down on the grass. The children had followed them. The little girl in the black smock was picking cowslips. She made big bouquets of the fresh yellow flowers and stuck her nose deep inside them, but her dark eyes, both innocent and crafty, remained fixed on the grown-ups. She looked at Lucille curiously and somewhat critically, the look of one woman to another.
"She looks scared," she thought. "I wonder why she's scared. He's not mean, that officer. I know him, he gives me money. and once he got my balloon that was caught in the branches of the big cedar tree. He's really handsome. More handsome than Daddy and all the boys round here. The lady has a pretty dress. Surreptitiously she moved closer and touched one of the folds of the dress with her little dirty finger. It was simple, light, made of grey cotton, and decorated only with a small collar and cuffs of pleated linen. She tugged on the dress rather hard, and Lucille suddenly turned round. The little girl jumped back, but Lucille looked through her with wide, anxious eyes. The little girl could see that the lady had gone very pale and that her lips were trembling. For sure she was afraid of being alone here with the German, as if he would hurt her. He was talking to her so nicely. But then again he was holding her hand so tightly that there was no way she could escape. All boys were the same, the little girl thought vaguely. Whether they were big or small, they liked teasing girls and scaring them. She stretched out in the tall grass, which was so high that it hid her from sight. It felt wonderful to be so tiny and invisible, with the grass tickling her neck, her legs, her eyelids. The German and the lady were talking quietly. He had turned white as a sheet, too. Now and again she could hear him holding back his loud voice as if he wanted to shout or cry but didn't dare. The little girl couldn't understand anything he said. She vaguely thought he might be talking about his wife and the lady's husband. She heard him say several times, "If you were happy, I see how you live. I know that you're all alone, that your husband has abandoned you. I've asked people in the village." Happy? Wasn't she happy then, the lady who had such pretty dresses, a beautiful house? Anyway, the lady didn't want him to feel sorry for her. She wanted to leave. She told him to let go of her and to stop talking. My word, it wasn't she who was scared. Now it was him, in spite of his big boots and proud look. He was the nervous one now. At that moment, a ladybird landed on the little girl's hand. She watched it a while. She wanted to kill it, but she knew it was bad luck to kill one of God's creatures, so she just blew on it, very gently at first, to see it lift its delicate, transparent wings. Then she blew with all her might, so that the little insect must have felt it was on a raft caught in a storm at sea. The ladybird flew off.
"It's on your arm, madame,"
the little girl shouted. Once again the officer and the lady turned and looked at her, but without really seeing her. Meanwhile, the officer made an impatient gesture with his hand, as if he were chasing away a fly. "I'm staying right here," the little girl said to herself defiantly. "And first of all, what are they doing here, a man and a woman? They should be in the sitting room." Mischievously, she strained to hear them. What were they talking about?
"I'll never forget you," said the officer, his voice low and trembling. "Never."
A large cloud covered half the sky. All the fresh bright colours in the garden turned grey. The lady was picking some little purple flowers and tearing them up.
"It's not possible," she said on the verge of tears.
"What's not possible?"
the little girl wondered.
"Of course I've also thought about it. I admit it, I'm not talking about love, but I would have liked to have a friend like you. I've never had any friends. I have no one. But it's not possible."
"Because of other people," said the officer scornfully. She just looked at him proudly.
"Other people? If I myself felt innocent, then no. There can be nothing between us."
"There are many things you will never be able to erase. The day we spent together when it rained, the piano, this morning, our walks in the woods."
"Oh, but I shouldn't have."
"But you did. It's too late. There's nothing you can do about it. All that was..." The little girl rested her face on her folded arms and heard nothing more than a distant murmur, like the humming of a bumblebee. That big cloud, bordered with burning rays of sunlight, meant it would rain. What if it suddenly started raining? What would the lady and the officer do? Wouldn't it be funny to see them running in the rain, her with a straw hat and him with his beautiful green cape? But they could hide in the garden. If they followed her, she could show them a bower where no one would be able to see them. "It's 12 o'clock now," she thought when she heard the church bells ringing the Angelus. Are they going to go home for lunch? What do rich people eat? Fromage blanc, like us. Bread, potatoes, sweets. What if I ask them for some sweets?
She went up to them and was going to tug at their hands to ask for some sweets. She was a bold little girl, this Rose, when she saw them suddenly jump up and stand there shaking.
Yes, the gentleman and the lady were shaking, just like when she was up in the cherry tree at school, her mouth stuffed full of cherries, and she heard the teacher shouting, "Rose, you little thief, come down from there at once." But they hadn't seen the teacher.
It was a soldier, standing to attention, who was talking very quickly in an incomprehensible language. The words coming out of his mouth sounded like water rushing over a bed of rocks. The officer moved away from the lady, who looked pale and dishevelled. "What is it?" she murmured. "What is he saying?" The officer seemed as upset as she was. He was listening without hearing. Finally, his pale face lit up with a smile. "He says they have found everything, but the old gentleman's false teeth are broken because the children have been playing with them. They tried to cram them in the mouth of the stuffed bulldog." Both of them, the officer and the lady, gradually seemed to come out of their stupor and return to earth. They looked down at the little girl and saw her this time. The officer tugged at her ear. "What have you little devils been up to?" But his voice quivered. And in the lady's laugh you could hear the echo of stifled sobs. She laughed like someone who had been very frightened and couldn't forget, while laughing, that she'd had a narrow escape. Little Rose was bothered and tried in vain to run off. She wanted to say,
"The false teeth, yes, well, we wanted to see if the bulldog would look vicious with some brand new teeth."
But she was afraid the officer would get angry. Seen close up, he seemed very big and scary. So she just whined,
"We didn't do anything. We didn't. We didn't even see any false teeth."
Meanwhile, children were coming over from all directions. They were all talking at once with their young, shrill voices.
"Stop! Stop! Be quiet!" the lady begged.
"Never mind. We're just happy to have found everything else." An hour later, a gang of kids in dirty clothes came out of the Perrins' garden, followed by two German soldiers pushing a wheelbarrow, containing a basket of china cups, a sofa with its four legs in the air, one was broken, a plush photograph album, a birdcage that the Germans mistook for the salad dryer, and many other items. Bringing up the rear were Lucille and the officer. Curious women stared at them as they walked through the village. They didn't speak to each other, the women noticed. They didn't even look at each other, and they were deathly pale, the officer's expression cold and impenetrable.
"She must have given him a piece of her mind," the women whispered. "Said it was shameful to get a house into that state. He's furious. Goodness gracious, they're not used to people standing up for themselves. She's right, we're not dogs. She's brave, that young Angelier lady. She's not afraid."
One of them, who was tending a goat, the little old woman with white hair and blue eyes who'd run into the Angelier ladies on their way back from Vespers that Easter Sunday and had said to them,
"These Germans, I've heard they're bad and evil,"
even came up to Lucille and whispered to her as she passed,
"Good for you, madame. Show them we're not afraid. Your prisoner of war will be proud of you," she added.
And she began to cry, not that she had a prisoner herself to cry over. She was long past the age of having a husband or a son at war. She cried because prejudice outlives passion and because she was sentimentally patriotic. Chapter 15. Whenever the elder Madame Angelier and the German met each other, they both instinctively stepped back. On the officer's part, this could have been interpreted as a sign of exaggerated courtesy, the desire not to impose his presence on the mistress of the house. He had almost the air of a thoroughbred horse, leaping away from a snake it sees at its feet. Madame Angelier, on the other hand, didn't even bother to disguise the shudder that ran through her, leaving her looking stiff and terrified, as if she'd come into contact with some disgusting, dangerous animal. But the moment lasted for only an instant. A good education is precisely designed to correct the instincts of human nature. The officer would draw himself up, put on the rigid, serious expression of an automaton, then bow and click his heels together.
"Oh, that Prussian salute!" Madame Angelier would groan,
without thinking that this greeting was, in fact, exactly what she should have expected from a man born in Western Germany, since it was unlikely to be an Arab kiss of the hand or an English handshake. As for Madame Angelier, she would clasp her hands in front of her like a nun who's been sitting at someone's deathbed and gets up to greet a member of his family suspected of anti-clericalism. During these encounters, various expressions would cross Madame Angelier's face. False respect. You're in charge here. Disapproval. Everyone knows who you are, you heathen. Submission. Let us offer up our hatred to the Lord. And finally, a flash of fierce joy. Just you wait, my friend. You'll be burning in hell while I'm finding peace in Jesus. Although this final thought was replaced in Madame Angelier's mind by the desire she felt every time she saw a member of the occupying forces. I hope he'll soon be at the bottom of the English Channel. For everyone was expecting an attempt to invade England, if not imminently, then very soon. Taking her desires for reality, Madame Angelier even came to believe the German looked like a drowned man, pallid, swollen, thrown about by the waves. It was this thought alone that allowed her to look human again, allowed the shadow of a smile to pass over her lips like the final rays of a dying star, and allowed her to reply to the German when he asked after her health, "Thank you for asking. I am as well as can be expected." Mournfully stressing these final words to imply, "as well as I can be, given the disastrous situation France is in." Lucille walked behind Madame Angelier. She'd become colder, more distracted, more rebellious than usual. She would nod silently as she walked away from the German. He too was silent. But, thinking no one could see, he would watch her for a long time as she walked away. Madame Angelier seemed to have eyes in the back of her head to catch him. Without even turning round, she would mutter angrily to Lucille, "Pay no attention to him. He's still there." She could only breathe freely after the door had been shut behind them. Then she would give her daughter-in-law a withering look and say, "You've done something different to your hair today." Or, "You're wearing your new dress, aren't you?" Concluding sarcastically, "It's not very flattering." And yet, despite the waves of hatred she felt towards Lucille, because she was there and her own son was not, in spite of everything she might have imagined or suspected, she never thought her daughter-in-law and the German could possibly care for each other. After all, people judge one another according to their own feelings. It is only the miser who sees others enticed by money, the lustful who see others obsessed by desire. To Madame Angelier, a German was not a man. He was the personification of cruelty, perversity, and hatred. For anyone else to feel differently was preposterous, incredible. She couldn't imagine Lucille in love with a German, any more than she could imagine a woman mating with some mythical creature, a unicorn, a dragon, or the monster Sainte-Marthe killed to free Tarascon. Nor did it seem possible that the German could be in love with Lucille. Madame Angelier refused to accord him any human feelings. She interpreted his long looks as a further attempt to insult this already defiled French home, as a way of feeling cruel pleasure at having the mother and wife of a prisoner of war at his mercy. What she called Lucille's insensitivity irritated her more than anything else. She's trying out new hairstyles, wearing new dresses. Doesn't she realise the German will think she's doing it for him? How degrading. She wanted to cover Lucille's face with a mask and dress her in a sack. It pained her to see Lucille looking healthy and beautiful. She was suffering. And all this time, my son, my own son. It was for Madame Angelier a moment of intense pleasure when they ran into the German in the hall one day and saw he was very pale and wore his arm in a sling, quite ostentatiously, in Madame Angelier's opinion. She was outraged to hear Lucille quickly ask, without thinking, "What happened to you, mein Herr?"
"I came off a horse, a difficult animal I was riding for the first time."
"You don't look well," said Lucille when she saw the German's haggard face. "You should go and lie down."
"No, no, it's only a graze. And in any case," he indicated the sound of the regiment going past their windows, "manoeuvres."
"What, again?"
"We are at war," he said. He smiled slightly, and after a brief salute, he left.
What are you doing?
Madame Angelier exclaimed sharply. Lucille had pushed aside the curtain and was watching the soldiers go by.
You have absolutely no sense of propriety. When Germans march by, the windows and shutters should be closed, like in 70.
Yes, when they march into a town for the first time. But since they walk around our streets nearly every day, we'd be condemned to perpetual darkness if we followed tradition to the letter, Lucille replied impatiently. It was a stormy night. A yellowish light fell on all the soldiers. They held their heads high and moved their lips in song. Their music began softly, as if restrained, suppressed, but it would soon burst forth into a magnificent, solemn chorale.
"They've got some funny songs," the local said. "You can't help listening. They're like prayers."
A streak of red lightning flashed across the setting sun and seemed to pour blood over the tight-fitting helmets, the green uniforms, the officer on horseback who commanded the detachment. Even Madame Angelier was impressed.
"If only it were an omen," she murmured.
Manoeuvres finished at midnight. Lucille heard the sound of the courtyard doors open and close again. She recognised the officer's footsteps in the hall. She sighed. She couldn't sleep. Another bad night. They were all the same now, miserable sleeplessness or confused nightmares. She was up by 6 o'clock, but that didn't help. All it did was to make the days longer, emptier. The cook told the Angelier ladies that the officer had come home ill and had been visited by the major, who'd seen he had a fever and ordered him to stay in his room. At noon, 2 German soldiers arrived with a meal that the injured man wouldn't eat. He was staying in his room, but he wasn't staying in bed. They could hear him, pacing back and forth, and the monotonous footsteps annoyed Madame Angelier so much that she retired immediately after lunch. This was not like her. Usually she would spend the afternoon in the drawing-room doing her accounts or knitting. Only after 4 o'clock would she go up to her rooms on the second floor, where she was insulated from all noise. Finally, Lucille could breathe easily. She sometimes wondered what her mother-in-law did up there in the darkness. She closed the shutters and windows and never put on a light so she couldn't be reading. Besides, she never read. Maybe she kept on knitting in the dark, making great long scarves for the prisoners of war with the confidence of a blind woman who doesn't need to look at what she's doing. Or was she praying? Sleeping? She would come downstairs at 7 o'clock without a single strand of hair out of place, stiff and silent in her black dress. On this day and the ones that followed, Lucille heard her lock her bedroom door. Then nothing else. The house seemed dead. Only the German's steady footsteps broke the silence. But Madame Angelier didn't hear them. She was safely tucked away behind her thick walls, all sound deadened by her draperies. Hers was a large, dark, heavily furnished room. Madame Angelier would begin by closing the shutters and curtains to make it even darker. Then she would sink into a large green armchair with tapestry upholstery, fold her translucent hands in her lap, and close her eyes. Sometimes a few bright, rare tears trickled down her cheeks, the reluctant tears of the very old, who have finally accepted that sorrow is futile. She would wipe them away almost angrily, and sitting up straight murmur, "Come along now, aren't you tired? You've been running again, and right after lunch when you should be digesting your food. You're sweating. Come along, Gaston, bring your little stool, put it here next to Mama. You can read for me. But rest for a while first. You can lay your little head on Mama's lap." Softly, lovingly, she stroked imaginary curls. It was neither delirium nor the first signs of madness. Never had she been more totally lucid and aware of herself. It was deliberate play-acting, the only thing that brought her some solace, in the same way as morphine or wine. In the darkness and the silence, she could relive the past. She resurrected moments she herself had thought were lost forever. Treasured memories resurfaced. She would remember certain words her son had said, certain intonations in his voice, a gesture he made with his chubby little hands when he was a baby, memories that, truly, for just an instant, could take her back in time. It was no longer her imagination, but reality itself, rediscovered through her enduring memories, for nothing could change the fact that these things had actually happened. Absence, even death, could not erase the past. The pink smock her son had worn, the way he cried and held out his hand to her when he'd been stung by nettles, all these things had happened, and it was within her power, as long as she was still alive, to bring them back to life. All she needed was solitude, darkness, the furniture around her, and these objects that her son had touched. She would vary her hallucinations to suit her mood. Not content merely with the past, she anticipated the future. She moulded the present to her will. Though she lied and deceived herself, the lies were her own creation, and she cherished them. For very brief moments she was happy. Her happiness was not hampered by the restrictions of reality. Everything was possible, everything within reach. First of all, the war was over. That was the starting point of her dream, the springboard from which she could launch herself towards endless joy. The war was over. It was a day like any other. Tomorrow, why not? She would know nothing until the very last minute. She didn't read the papers anymore, didn't listen to the radio. It would be like a bolt from the blue. One morning she would go down to the kitchen and see the cook, wide-eyed. "Haven't you heard, madame?" The surrender of the King of Belgium, the fall of Paris, the arrival of the Germans, the armistice. She had learned about all these in just this way. Well, why not peace, too? Why not? "Madame, it seems it's all over. It seems no one's fighting anymore. There's no more war. The prisoners are coming home." She couldn't care less if it was the English or the Germans who had won. All she cared about was her son. White as a ghost, eyes closed, she created the scene in her mind with the same abundance of detail found in the paintings of madmen. She could see each and every line on Gaston's face, his hair, his clothing, the laces on his army boots. She could hear every inflection in his voice. She stretched out her hands and whispered, "Well, come inside. Don't you recognize your own house?" During these first moments, Lucille faded away, and Gaston belonged to her and her alone. She would be careful not to cry and kiss him for too long. She would make him a good lunch, run his bath, tell him immediately about his affairs. "You know, I took good care of them. You remember that piece of land you wanted near the Etang Neuil? I bought it. It's yours. I also bought that meadow of the Mormors that borders on ours, the one the Viscount was adamant he wouldn't sell to us. Well, I waited for the right moment. I got what I wanted. Are you pleased? I've put your gold, your silverware, the family jewellery, all in a safe place. I did everything, courageously, all by myself. If I had to count on your wife. You can see I'm your only real friend, can't you? That I'm the only one who really understands you. But go and see your wife, my boy, go on. Just don't expect much from her. She's a cold, rebellious creature. Together, though, we'll be able to bend her to our will better than I could do alone. She eludes me with her long silences, whereas you have the right to ask her what she's thinking. You're the master of the house. You can demand to know. Go, go and see her. Take from her what's rightfully yours, her beauty, her youth. I've heard that in Dijon..." "You shouldn't, my dear Gaston. A mistress is expensive. But I'm sure your long absence will have made you love our old house even more. Oh, what wonderful, peaceful days we're going to spend together," murmured Madame Angélier. She'd stood up and was walking around the room, holding an imaginary hand and leaning against a phantom shoulder. "Come on, let's go downstairs. I've had a light meal prepared for you in the sitting room. You've lost weight, Gaston. Come, you've got to have something to eat." Without thinking, she opened the door, went down the staircase. Yes, this was how she would come down from her room in the evening, opening the door to surprise the children. Gaston in an armchair next to the window, with his wife by his side, reading to him. It was his wife's duty, her role, to look after him, to amuse him. When he was recovering from typhoid fever, Lucille used to read the newspapers to him. Her voice was soft and pleasant. She couldn't deny that. Even she herself had sometimes enjoyed listening to Lucille read. A soft, low voice. But was it that voice she could hear now? No, she must be dreaming. She had allowed her imagination to drift beyond the acceptable limit. She pulled herself up, took a few steps, and walked into the sitting room. The armchair had been moved next to the window, and sitting in it, his injured arm leaning on the armrest, smoking a pipe, his feet on the little stool where Gaston used to sit as a child, she saw the German in his green uniform, the invader, the enemy. And next to him, Lucille, who was reading a book out loud. For a moment, no one said a word. They both stood up. Lucille dropped the book she was holding. The officer quickly picked it up from the floor and put it on the table. "Madame," he muttered, "your daughter-in-law was kind enough to allow me to come and keep her company for a few moments." The old woman, very pale, nodded. "You're in charge here. And since some new books were sent to me from Paris, I took the liberty of..." "You're in charge here," Madame Angelier said again. She turned and walked out. Lucille heard her say to the cook, "I'll be staying in my room from now on. You will bring my meals to me upstairs." "Today, madame?" "Today, tomorrow, and for as long as this gentleman is in the house." When she'd gone upstairs and they could no longer hear her footsteps in the depths of the house, the German whispered, "That will be heaven." Chapter 16. The Viscountess de Montmore suffered from insomnia. She was in tune with the cosmos. All the great contemporary problems touched her soul. When she thought about the future of the white race, or Franco-German relations, or the threat posed by the Freemasons and communism, sleep was banished. Chills ran through her body. She would get up, put on an old worm-eaten fur wrap, and go out into the grounds. She despised dressing up, perhaps because she had lost hope that putting on a pretty dress could counterbalance the overall effect of her plainness. She had a long red nose, an awkward figure, and bad skin. Or perhaps because of a natural sense of pride that made her believe others couldn't help but see her striking qualities, even beneath a battered felt hat or a knitted wool coat, spinach green and canary yellow, that the cook would have rejected in horror. Or perhaps out of her contempt for trivial detail. "How important is it, my dear?" she would say sweetly to her husband when he criticised her for coming down to dinner wearing two different shoes. But she quickly returned to earth when it came to overseeing the servants' work or managing their estate. Whenever she couldn't sleep, she would walk through the grounds reciting poetry, or rush to the henhouse and examine the three enormous locks that protected the door. She kept an eye on the cows. Since the war had started, no one grew flowers on the lawns any more. The cattle slept there. And in the soft moonlight, she would stroll through the vegetable garden and count the maize. She was being robbed. Before the war, it was almost unheard of to grow maize in this rich area, where poultry was fed on wheat and oats. Now, though, the requisitioning agents searched the lofts for sacks of wheat, and the housewives had no grain to feed their hens. People had come to the chateau to ask for feed, but the Montmores were hoarding it, mainly for themselves, but also for all their friends and acquaintances in the area. The farmers were angry. "We'd be happy to pay," they said. She wouldn't have charged them anything, actually, but that wasn't the issue, and they sensed it. They could tell they were up against a kind of brotherhood, like the Freemasons, a closing of ranks that meant that they and their money were insignificant compared to the satisfaction the Montmores got from doing a favour for the Baron de Montrefort or the Countess de Pignepoule. Since they weren't allowed to buy, they simply took. There were no longer any gamekeepers at the chateau. They'd been taken prisoner, and there weren't enough men in the area to replace them. It was also impossible to find workmen or the materials to rebuild the crumbling walls. The farmers got in through the gaps, poached whatever they wanted, fished in the lake, stole hens, corn or tomato plants, just helped themselves to anything, in fact. Monsieur de Montmore's situation was complicated.
On the one hand, he was the mayor and didn't want to upset his constituents. On the other, he naturally cared about his estate. Nevertheless, he would have chosen to turn a blind eye to it all if it hadn't been for his wife, who rejected any compromise or show of weakness on principle. "All you want is a quiet life," she said sharply to her husband. "Our Lord himself said, 'I have not come to bring peace, but the sword.'" "You're not Jesus Christ," Amaury replied grumpily. But it had long ago been accepted in the family that the Viscountess had the soul of an apostle and that her opinions were prophetic. What was more, Amaury was even more inclined to adopt the Viscountess's judgments, since she was the one with the family fortune, and she kept her purse strings tightly closed. He therefore loyally supported her and waged a bitter war against the poachers, the thieves, the teacher who didn't go to mass, and the postman, who was suspected of being a member of the Popular Front, even though he had ostentatiously hung a picture of Maréchal Pétain on the door of the telephone booth in the post office. And so the Viscountess walked through her grounds on a beautiful June evening and recited the poetry she intended her protégés from the school to recite on Mother's Day. She would have liked to have composed a poem herself. However, her talent was really for prose. When she wrote, she felt the deluge of ideas so powerfully that she often had to put down her pen and run her hands under cold water to force back into them the blood that had rushed to her head. The obligation to make things rhyme was unbearable. Perhaps, therefore, instead of the poem to the glory of the French mother she would so like to compose, she would write an incantation in prose. "Oh, mother!" would exclaim one of the youngest pupils, dressed all in white and holding a bouquet of wild flowers in her hand. "Oh, mother, let me see your sweet face above my little bed, while the storm rages outside. The sky darkens the earth, but a radiant dawn approaches. Smile, oh, kind mother! See how your child is following the Maréchal, who holds peace and happiness in his hands. Join me and all the children, all the mothers in France, to form a blissful circle around the venerable wise one who restores hope in our hearts." Madame de Montmorel spoke these words out loud, and they echoed in the silent grounds. When inspiration took hold of her, she lost all control. She strode back and forth, then collapsed onto the damp moss, and sat in meditation for a long time, her fur wrap pulled tight round her thin shoulders. Whenever she reflected in this way, her thoughts quickly led to passionate resentment. Why, when she was so gifted, wasn't she surrounded by love, or even the warmth of admiration? Why had her husband married her for her money? Why wasn't she popular? When she walked through the village, the children would hide or laugh behind her back. She knew they called her the madwoman. It was very hard being hated. Yet look at how much she'd done for the local people. The library, how lovingly she had chosen the books, good books to elevate the soul, but which left them cold. The girls wanted her to get novels by Maurice de Cobra. These young people. Educational films, just as unpopular as the books. A village fete every year in the grounds, with a show put on by the schoolchildren. Yet she had not been oblivious to the harsh criticisms bandied about. They held it against her that the chairs had been set up in the garage, because the bad weather had made it impossible to enjoy being outside. Oh, what did these people want? Did they expect her to invite them into the chateau? They'd be the ones who felt embarrassed if she did. Ah, this deplorable new way of thinking that was sweeping through France. She alone could recognise it and give it a name. The people were becoming Bolsheviks. She had thought the defeat would be a lesson to them, that they would see the errors of their ways and be forced to respect for their leaders. But no, they were worse than ever. Sometimes she, a passionate patriot, yes, she, was actually glad the enemy was there, she thought, listening to the German guards keeping watch on the road alongside the grounds. They patrolled the village and the surrounding countryside all night long in groups of four.
You could hear the sound of church bells ringing, a sweet, familiar sound that gently lulled people as they slept, and at the same time the hammering of boots, the rattling of weapons as in a prison courtyard. Yes, the Viscountess de Montmar had reached the point where she wondered if she shouldn't thank the good Lord for the German occupation of France. Not that she actually liked them. Lord knows, she couldn't stand them. But without them, who knew? It was all very well for Amaury to say, "Communists, the people around here, but they're richer than you are." It wasn't simply a question of money or land. It was also, especially, a question of zeal. She vaguely sensed this without being able to explain it. Perhaps they didn't really understand the idea of communism, but it appealed to their desire for equality, a desire so powerful that even having money and land became frustrating rather than satisfying. It was an insult, as they put it, to own livestock worth a fortune, to be able to send their sons to private school, to buy silk stockings for their daughters, and in spite of all that, still feel inferior to the Montmars. The farmers felt they were never given enough respect, especially since the Viscount was made mayor. The old farmer who had been mayor before him had been warm and friendly to everyone. He might have been greedy, vulgar, harsh and insulting to his constituents. He got away with it. Yet they reproached the Viscount de Montmar for being haughty. What did they expect? For him to stand up when they came into the mayor's office, to see them to the door or something? They couldn't bear any hint of superiority, anyone wealthier or anyone who came from a better family. No matter what people said, the Germans had good qualities. They were a disciplined race, docile, thought Madame de Montmar, as she listened almost with pleasure to the rhythmical footsteps fading away, the harsh voices shouting, "Achtung!" in the distance. It must be very nice to own a lot of property in Germany. Whereas here... She was consumed by anxiety. It was getting darker, and she was about to go back into the house when she saw, or thought she saw, a shadowy figure moving along the wall. Head down, it disappeared into the vegetable garden. Finally, she was going to catch one of these thieves. She quivered with pleasure. It was typical of her not to be afraid. Amaury was always worried about confrontations, but not she. Danger aroused the huntress in her. She hid behind some trees and followed the shadowy figure, holding the pair of shoes she had found hidden in the moss at the foot of the wall. The thief was walking in his socks to make less noise. She worked her way round so that he ran straight into her as he was coming out of the vegetable garden. He jumped back and tried to run away, but she shouted at him contemptuously, "I've got your shoes, my friend. The police will soon find out whose they are." The man stopped and started walking towards her. It was Benoît Savary. They stood, staring at each other without saying a word. "Well, that's a fine thing to do," the Viscountess said finally, her voice trembling with hatred. She despised him. Of all the farmers, he was the most insolent, the most stubborn. Whether it was about the hay, the livestock, the fences, everything and nothing, the chateau and the farm waged silent, interminable guerrilla warfare against each other. "Well," she said indignantly, "now I know who the thief is, and I'm going to tell the mayor immediately. You'll live to regret this."
"Tell me, do I talk to you like that? Do I?" "Take your plants," said Benoît, throwing them down on the ground where they lay scattered in the moonlight. "Didn't we offer to pay for them? Do you think we don't have enough money to buy them?" "But every time we ask you for a favour, not that it will cost you anything, no. You'd rather see us starve to death."
"Thief, thief, thief!"
the Viscountess kept shrieking as he talked.
"The mayor! I don't give a damn about the mayor. Go and get him, then. I'll say it to his face."
"How dare you speak to me like that?"
"Because we've all had enough around here, if you want to know the truth. You have everything and you keep everything. Your wood, your fruit, your fish, your game, your ends. You wouldn't sell any of it. You wouldn't give any of it away for all the money in the world. Your husband, the mayor, makes fancy speeches about helping each other and the rest of it. Ha! You must be bloody joking. Your chateau's cram full of stuff, from the cellar to the attic. Everyone knows that. They've seen. Are we asking for charity? No. But that's exactly what bothers you, isn't it? You'd be happy to do it as charity because you like humiliating poor people. But when it comes to doing a favour, as equals, I'm paying for what I take, you're off like a shot. Why wouldn't you sell me your plants?
That's my business. And this is my house, I believe, you insolent.
That corn wasn't even for me, I swear. I'd rather die than ask people like you for anything. It was for Louise, because her husband's a prisoner and I wanted to help her out. I help people.
By stealing?
Well, what else are we supposed to do? You're heartless and stingy with it. What else are we supposed to do? He repeated furiously. And I'm not the only one to help myself here. Everything you refuse to give away without a good reason, everything you keep out of pure spite, we're going to take. And it's not over yet. Just wait until autumn. Your husband, the mayor, will be hunting with the Germans.
That's not true. That's a lie. He's never gone hunting with the Germans.
She stamped her foot angrily, wild with rage. Again, that stupid slander. The Germans did invite them both to one of their hunts last winter. It was true. They had declined, but they couldn't refuse to attend the dinner in the evening. Whether they liked it or not, they had to follow the government's orders. And besides, these German officers were cultured men, after all. What separates or unites people is not their language, their laws, their customs, their principles, but the way they hold their knife and fork.
When it's autumn, Benoit continued, he'll be hunting with the Germans. But I'll be back, I will, back to your grounds, and I won't care if it's rabbits or foxes I get. You can have your groundsmen, your gamekeepers and your dogs chase after me as much as you want. They won't be as clever as Benoit Savary. They've been running after me plenty all winter without catching me.
I won't go and get the groundsmen or the gamekeepers. I'll get the Germans. They scare you, don't they? You can show off all you like, but when you see a German uniform, you keep your head down.
Listen, I've seen them Boche up close, I have, in Belgium and at the Somme. I'm not like your husband. Where was he during the war? In an office where he could treat everyone like shit.
You vulgar little man.
In Chalon-sur-Saône, that's where he was, your husband, from September till the day the Germans arrived. Then he cleared off. That's his idea of war.
You are repulsive. Get out of here or I'll scream. Get out of here or I'll call them.
That's it, call the Boche. You must be really glad they're here, eh? They're like the police. They watch your property. You'd better pray to the good Lord that they stay a long time, because the day they leave...
He left his sentence unfinished. Quickly grabbing his shoes, the evidence from her hands, he put them on, climbed over the wall and disappeared. Almost immediately she heard the sound of German footsteps getting closer.
Oh, I really hope they caught him. I really hope they've killed him,
the Viscountess said to herself as she ran towards the chateau.
What a man! What a species! What vile people! That's what Bolshevism is, exactly that! My God, what has happened to everyone? When Papa was alive, if you caught a poacher in the woods, he'd cry and beg for forgiveness. Naturally, he'd be forgiven. Papa, who was goodness personified, would shout, make a scene, then give him a glass of wine in the kitchen. I saw that happen more than once when I was a child, but then the farmers were poor. Since they've got money, it's as if all their worst instincts have resurfaced. The chateau's crammed full of stuff from the cellar to the attic, she repeated furiously. Well, and what about his house? They're richer than we are. What exactly do they want? It's envy. They're being eaten up by base feelings. That Savary is dangerous. He bragged about how he came to hunt